That's better. Okay. So, chapter 9 is the first of two chapters in which Job responds to Bildad. He has a lot to say. You'll be shocked to know. Bildad has said, God is just no matter what you think, and he has brought one parable, two parables, however you want to say it. What we're going to see here is that Job will turn the words of Eliphaz and Bildad against them. That's number one. Number two is we will see less of a focus on demonstrating that evil takes place, and more Job taking it as a given and using it as a basis to challenge God. In other words, Job's starting point is people suffer and they don't deserve it. He doesn't feel the need to demonstrate that. It's simply so, and therefore, I'm challenging God. He's also going to evolve further in terms of displaying his outrage, in that for the first time, we will see him address God directly and harshly. You won't believe what you read when you see how he talks to God. I gave you a little bit of an outline of the chapter. I reserve the right, as we go through it, to alter some of the verses a little bit in terms of where I put them, but I think this is right. The first part of it is the statement that God is mighty and there's no winning a debate with God. But we'll see what that means, because that doesn't sound, it isn't necessarily as positive as it sounds right now. And this is not an accepting of the idea that God is right. It's accepting the idea that God's going to win. Two different things. Correct. Then he's going to spend a while talking about why he can't win a debate with God and give a few different explanations for why. He will then say the world is run wickedly, and then, we're not getting to it this week, but the very end of chapter 9 through chapter 10, he says what he would tell God given the chance. And he words it as, you know, a conversation, not a conversation, it's kind of one-sided, but a monologue addressed to God. So as we read this, we need to think through, how is this a response to Bildad, number one? And number two, what is it that triggered this evolution in him to get him to go this step? So we begin with the first three sentences of chapter 9. Okay, we're on page 1631. Vayan Iyo Vayomar, Job declared and said, Omnam Yadati Kichain. He says, it's true. I know that it is so. Umayitz Dak Enosh Im Kael. And how can man be tzaddik with God? Tzaddik meaning? Righteous? Okay, I'll tell you that for now.
Here yeah. It says just.
Just. Okay, like the same idea. Okay. How could a person be righteous with God? Im yachpots lariv imo. If he were to desire to actually quarrel with God. And this is the first time in the book that we see what will be a major theme, desire to haul God into court and have a trial. This is the beginning of that, and you'll see it very, very strongly as he goes through this. If he were to wish to quarrel with God, Lo ya'anenu achat mini aleph. I hate to tell you this, but God's not answering. Not even one in a thousand times that you yell is God going to say, well, here's the answer to your complaint. That's his opening salvo. Is he says, you can't, he says, you can't be found tzaddik with God. He says, it's true. Now, my first question is, what's true? It's true. What's it?
Well, it's clearly a response to his... I mean, I think it's a response to his friends. I'm not sure if we say it's just to the most recent argument, but it's responding to that.
I want to point to a particular sentence that has been said to... you're right. It clearly has to be a response to something that's been said to him. But there's something specific. If you take a look at the second half of the sentence... And if you've been reading along in the Hebrew, you will know what he's responding to.
I mean, we had, because he chooses the word tzaddik, which is, I think, important.
Yeah.
I just go back to the last parak, and it says, Hey, El, Lo Yameh, Tzatam. Like, God's going to be there for the... Mm-hmm. We've been told all along that, you know, in the end, the good will triumph, or you'll be okay. And I wonder whether he's questioning that.
Okay. Go further back in the same parak, though. Yes. That's one of the sentences he's got to be responding to. Chapter 8, sentence 3. Hakel yaveit mishpat. Will God corrupt justice? V'im shaka yaveit tzedek. Same idea. Will God corrupt righteousness? Tzedek is with God. He says, omnam. Cain, it's true. You got it. There's another sentence, though, that Eliphaz used that's even stronger as the source for what he's saying. Chapter 4, sentence 17. This is the one that jumped to mind for me, certainly. We spent a lot of time on this sentence. Ha'enosh me'aloka yitzdak. Right? Can a person be more righteous than God? And remember, we gave different explanations for why he's even asking that question. Right? Can a person be more righteous than God? To which he's saying, ma'yitzdak enosh me'aloka. He says, a person can't be righteous alongside God. You can't match God for righteousness. That's one way to read this sentence. However, yes, all right. We have to at some point, likely after we finish the book, we have to try to figure something out in terms of which names are used for God where. I don't know that we'll get anywhere, but yeah. Yes, correct. Right, you want to say? The statement he's making here is, it sounds like he's saying, you're right, God is righteous. Now, that doesn't fit the Job I've come to know and, well, love. If you take a look at source number 5, Mesudat David gives one answer, Dad Mikra gives a second answer. Mitzudat David, remember, goes with the approach that says, that Job says everything is being run by the stars. And this is going to go back to our question of, well, God is the one who put the stars in charge, so how does that absolve him of guilt? That's exactly the point. Rabbi David Altshuler says in his Mitzudat David commentary, Masha amarta hakel yaveit mishpat, when you said, back in chapter 8, sentence 3, will God corrupt justice? He says, you're right. I know that's true. God is just and fair and righteous. I accept those things. That's why I concluded that it's all the constellations. God wouldn't be the one zapping me, zapping my family, when I don't deserve it. But he says that doesn't let God off the hook. This is my problem. But all of my complaints, or kotlunati, rather singular, mau ha gimul kasher yitzdak enosh im kel alechet bidrachav. What is the nature of the reward for a person who is righteous with God, who goes, who walks in God's ways? Halo gam huna ezav lahan hagat ha'maracha. At the end, he's abandoned to the governance of the constellations. In other words, God was the one who put the stars in charge. And therefore, it doesn't solve the problem. What Job is saying, as Mitzudat David reads it, is his point is not to say God is righteous. What he's saying is, you know, I thought so, but I don't understand then how he could be allowing this to go on. He may be passively responsible, but he's still responsible. That's one take. In this take, the word tzaddik indeed means God is righteous. The same way that it was used by Eliphaz, the same way that it was used by Bildad, tzaddik means righteous. However, Dav Mikra points out another way to read this, and I think there's a lot to be said for the way that he reads this. The other way that you could read the word tzaddik is to say one who wins, one who is found righteous in the trial. When the judge finishes, when the gavel bangs, the one who won the case is the one who is declared to be tzaddik. And so take a look at source number 6, please. Amos Chacham in the Dad Mikra commentary writes, Yitzdak, yetzei tzaddik berivo im Elokim, emerge as tzaddik in his quarrel with God. Umashma uto kfula. He says the meaning of the word tzaddik is double. It could mean, yet say, Zakai bidino, to emerge innocent in his judgment, but it also could mean yetzei menatzeach berivo, to emerge victorious in his judgment. And so, if I read it that way, what he's doing is, he's turning to Eliphaz and Bildad, this is brilliant, he's turning to Eliphaz and Bildad and saying, you said God is tzaddik, and I agree with you, God is tzaddik. But you said God is tzaddik, meaning God is righteous. I say it just means God wins the argument. A person can't win an argument with God. That doesn't mean that the person is wrong. It just means that he's just not powerful enough to win. That's what Job is suggesting here, per Dan Mikra. And again, I think there's a lot to be said for that read. And he says, why? Because God isn't even going to answer the challenge. You can say whatever you want. You can have your day in court. You can allege whatever you would like to allege. But at the end of the day, it's not going to change anything. Yes, Sharon?
Well, maybe all this that's going on is trying to say, you're becoming upset by arguing with God. And by having all this happen, the reason for all this pain and suffering that he raises his consciousness and awareness and starts to develop in a higher level, like be more God.
Well, the problem is that it's Job himself talking. It's Job himself speaking. I'm not sure I would see him saying that to himself. That would be my challenge to reading it that way. So whichever way I read this, he has set the stage. Danny, you were going to say he has set the stage by saying that that God isn't going to acknowledge that I'm right. I'm not going to win this debate, and then he continues with a perfect example of what we have called, using Newsom's phrase, linguistic sabotage, where he's going to take language and use it in this wildly different way. Take a look, starting in sentence 4. You should recognize some of these phrases. They show up in our liturgy. Chacham levav ve'amitz koach. Mi hikshai lav vayishlam. He says, God is wise of heart. He is mighty in strength. Who can hiksha a love? Hiksha might be tempted to read as to ask a question, but more likely it is to be kashe. Who can be tough with God? If you think of the parshiot we've just been reading, the Torah portions we've been reading, paro, right, with the hard heart. Who can be tough with God, vayishlam, and be found whole, or have peace? Hamatik harim v'lo yadao. He moves mountains, and the mountains don't even realize what's going on. Asher hafacham be'apo, he flips them in his rage. Hamargiz eretz mimekoma, he shakes the earth from its place. Ve'amudeha yitpalatzun, and the pillars that support it split. He's describing divine rage, which in and of itself is a difficult concept. The idea that God gets angry, and it may be part of his allegation, is that this is what God does because he is out of control. Ha'omer lacheres v'lo yizrach uva'ad kochavim yachtom. He tells the cheres. Cheres is the shemesh, the sun. This is a very odd thing, but we find it a few times in Tanakh, such as when Yeshua is buried in Timnat Cheres. The use of the word cheres to refer to the sun. Cheres literally is pottery. So I don't know if this has a root in people looking at the sun as a piece of pottery that's been heated in a fire. I have no idea whatsoever how it is that we come by the word cheres to refer to the sun, but you find it a few times in Tanakh. I looked and no one had an etymological suggestion. Ha'omer lacheres v'lo yizrach, he speaks to the sun and it won't shine, meaning if God decides, there's no sunlight. Uva'ad kochavim yachtom, he seals up the stars. Notesh shamayim livado, he extends the heavens alone. He doesn't need any assistance. V'dorecha b'matayam, and he trods upon the height of the seas. There are a few different explanations that are brought for the height of the seas. Rashi notes on this idea of extending the heavens alone. That's actually a verse that's used in the Midrash when they ask the question of where the malachim came from. Right? Malachim are the agents God uses to carry out his desires. Whatever it is that God wants to have happen, he uses a malach to do it. A malach could be a natural thing, as Rambam writes. However, we also have the idea of separate spiritual beings that are called malachim. And the problem is they don't show up in the days of creation. It isn't as though on day 4, it says, and God created the sun, moon, stars, and malachim. So where are they? So the classic midrash in Bereishit Rabbah says it's either day 2 or day 5. And for each one, it gives associations with various verses to explain why it's being said. It's not just random. But the point is, the earliest possible date is day 2. Lest anybody suggest that God had assistance in creating the world, because as Job says here, Notesh Shamayim Levado, he extended the heavens, day 1, heaven and earth, he extended that himself. There was no Malach Ra. So Rashi makes that point here. But he's describing divine might. Right? I mean, it's this glorious description, especially if you just read the first half of each sentence. The second half sometimes gets negative. But he extends the heavens alone. He tramples on, he treads upon the heights of the sea. Osa'ash kasil v'kima v'chadrei teman. He now refers to the stars. Okay? He creates the ash. Ash is often a moth. We actually used the word earlier in the book. He renders here in the art scroll Ush as Ursa Minor. Okay. Fine. Sorry? JPS also Ursa Minor?
Bear and Orion.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Orion is coming next. Orion is not there. Ksil Vikima is Orion and the Pleiades, for reasons that we'll come back to in a second. But that's what it's what we're referring to there with Ksil and Kima. Those who were in the Medrash class last year will recall that we talked about the Ksil and Kima then. We'll come back to that in a moment. But he creates these constellations, V'chadrei Teman, and literally the rooms of the south, which the commentators understand to refer to the stars that are not visible in the north, but that they have down south that they can see. So it's like they're in a room where they're not observable, you know, for us. God creates all of these stars, and then in Pasuk Yud, in sentence 10, sort of the ultimate, Oseh gedolot ad ein cheker, v'niflaot ad ein mispar. Yeah, it's from our David, and guess who else said it? Go back to chapter 5, sentence 9, please. Sound familiar? Oseh gedolot v'ein cheker niflaot ad ein mispar. He has one change, ad ein cheker versus v'ein cheker, but it's the same sentence. He's mocking Eliphaz. He's using the same sentence that Eliphaz used to describe divine greatness. He's using it to describe why he can't win with God, because God has all the power and the might on his side, and therefore I can't get my day in court. You talk about it as praise and how wonderful God is, and I use it to talk about how angry I am. It's really remarkable what he's doing. It's a shame no one reads Job. But now we understand why also, having gotten here. But that's what he's doing here. And to go back now to the stars, because that's really the end of a little subunit here. The Ksil and Kima are used various places in Tanakh. Orion and the Pleiades are used in various places. In Amos, they're used to illustrate the might of divine creation. He talks about there how God created Ksil and Kima. From an astronomical standpoint, they're close together in the sky. In the northern hemisphere, the Pleiades shines all night in November with Orion, Ksil, right nearby. But Orion is, after that, from January to March, is when Orion shines most within the sky, which means that the Pleiades are associated with the introduction of the cold, but then as Orion sets, then the heat comes in. So that's the way that they're viewed as being ushering in, first ushering in the winter, and then ushering in the warmth. Of course, March doesn't bring in warmth here, because we're in the wrong part of the world, but that's the way it's viewed. And therefore, if you take a look on your sheet, source number 7, the Talmud has an observation, Il malei chama shel kisil, if not for the heat of Orion, right, the heat that Orion brings in, the world could not withstand the cold that's ushered in by the Pleiades. But if not for the cold of the Pleiades, the world could not withstand the heat of Orion. In other words, these are more than just constellations. When he describes what God does, what God has the power to do, it's the regulation of our existence. It's the seasons. all of that is encompassed within this description of God as the creator of Kima and Kseel. And I brought for you source number 8. We won't read it aloud in the interest of time, but you can see it there. This idea that when God alters the Pleiades, that's what creates the Mabul. That's what creates the flood. But this is the point, that creating Kima and Kseel is divine regulation of the world. And I suppose if you bring in the flood, divine punishment as well. Okay. But he concludes this section with sentences 11 to 13. In which he says, Hain yavor alai velo er'eh viachalof velo avin lo. He's now going to summarize what he's been saying. He says, Hain yavor alai, if he is God. God could pass before me, and I wouldn't even see him. V'achalof. He could pass, v'lo avinlo, and I won't understand, I won't comprehend that he's even there. Hein yachtof, mi yeshivenu. He will yachtof. Most of the commentators take this like yachtof with a tet, to grab. Dat mikra offers another possibility that it means perhaps to break, to smash something. Either way, whether it is God grabbing or God smashing something, mi yeshivenu, who is going to turn him back? Who can resist God? Mi yomar elav ma ta'aseh, who can say to God, what in the world are you doing? And I noted for you on your sheet in source number 9 that the same line appears in Kohelet, in Ecclesiastes. The same mi yomar elav ma ta'aseh. Where else does that appear? In our liturgy? Not a good time. At a funeral, there's something called Siduk Hadin. Siduk Hadin is a set of verses that are recited at the graveside in which one accepts God as judge. So that this, Mi Omar Elav Matase, who can say to God, why did you do this? It's a fruitless question. That's part of the Siduk Hadin, and I think the reason for using that is fairly obvious. So he says, he concludes this section, Eloka lo yashiv apo. God is not going to withdraw his anger. In sentence 12, he said, who can turn God back? Now he's saying in sentence 13, God is not about to turn himself back. Tachtav shachachu ozrei rahav. Beneath God, shachachu, collapse, ozrei rahav. Those who help, rahav. So there are various explanations. I'm looking at the art scroll here. And they say those who assist the arrogant, Rahab being a term for arrogance. I've seen those who connect it to Egypt specifically, that Egypt was identified as Rahab. But the point that he's making is,
what is
Rahab? Right, so they're taking it here as arrogance, and that's probably a
and Egyptians being arrogant, therefore.
Correct. It's Rashi who he's quoting, who makes the association with them. He also does it because of the stars. Rashi does it fits in with the stars coming to battle against the Egyptians at the sea. But the point for Job here, what he's trying to get across is that he can't win, that God is too mighty, and that he is beneath God. Now, let me just see, because I lost the timer on there when I restarted. We have 3 minutes. Okay. The question you have to ask is, according to the view that that says that Job believes that the stars run the world, so what is this whole description of divine might, God moving mountains and so on? God doesn't do that. So I brought you on your sheets, in sources 10 and 11, Mitzudat David and Ralbag explain. Mitzudat David says, I'm not going to read it aloud, you can see it though. Mitzudat David, Rabbi Altshuler, says that granted that Job doubts that God is actually running things, he knows God has the strength to do these things. Or as Ralbag puts it, a little bit stronger, when he does his summary of the chapter, he says, Job isn't saying that God is directly responsible for things that happen. But he's asking, God has all this power, why doesn't he rearrange the universe so that things like what happened to me don't happen at all? He says, going back to his point in chapter 3, it would be better if I didn't exist than for me to go through all of these things. And God could have arranged that. He has all the power. So what he's saying here is fundamentally, number one, God is indeed tzaddik like you said. But not necessarily tzaddik meaning innocent. Tzaddik meaning he wins. That's number one. Number two, God holds all of the cards, and there can be no trial. And effectively, what I think Bildad has accomplished in his speech is to crystallize for Job the idea of suing God in order to demonstrate, I am just and the universe is not, I would like to sue. That's his. That's what has been inspired for him. So we'll pick up with that, God willing, next week.